Morris's girlfriend. She was shot in her apartment sometime during the night. The paper didn't say anything about the murders being related, and Sheriff Corker and his investigators weren't saying anything. I knew better, though. Sheriff Corker was definitely tying off loose ends. If Morris was going to be out of office, then Corker was making sure nobody would be going to the FBI or the TBI. Dead men and women tell no tales. I called Claire at noon. Four of them in one night, I said. These people are a lot nastier than I thought. Did you know about the girlfriend?
Of course I knew about the girlfriend.
Why didn't you use her?
Because the information we had on her wasn't exactly something you put on a billboard or whisper in a newspaper reporter's ear. Unless you're willing to share definitive proof, and we weren't willing to share. We had some excellent photos and some very clear video and audio tape, but they were gathered by people we don't want anyone to know about. It didn't matter, though. We were going to beat him by a landslide anyway.
I've always heard that all is fair in love and politics, I said. Do you mind telling me what you didn't want to put on a billboard?
Our people had tape and video and photos of Morris giving her drugs. She had a habit before they met that escalated. She wound up getting busted by the Knoxville cops. She asked him to use his influence to get her out of the jam, but these cops wanted money. So Morris apparently got the sheriff to start sending a fairly large amount of pills his way each month, and he gave them to Leslie Sabin. She sold them and gave two vice cops a cut. Her charges were dropped.
You just can't make this stuff up, I said.
How did you know about her, come to think of it? Claire said.
I might have followed Morris one day and just sort of stumbled across her.
And why would you have been following him?
No particular reason. I was just curious about how he went about his day.
What else did you know about her?
Not much. The paper said she was a third-year law student at the University of Tennessee.
She'd done an internship at the district attorney's office, Claire said. That's how they met.
I remembered thinking she was probably a law student, but I didn't say anything to Claire about it. And I thought about the shoebox Morris was carrying the day I saw him go into her apartment. The box must have been full of drugs.
Has anyone from the sheriff's department been in contact with you? Claire said.
No, not a peep.
I guess no news is good news as far as they're concerned.
I just hope they don't try to pin any of these killings on me.
There's no way they could, is there?
I don't think so, but it's happened to me before. So what now? Who takes over at the district attorney's office?
Generally, if an elected official dies in office, someone is appointed to replace him until the next election. But since the next election is only 2 days away and you're obviously going to win because you're now unopposed, there won't be any point in putting someone else in the office. Normally, you wouldn't take over until the first day of January, but under these circumstances, I think my grandfather will call the governor and persuade him to appoint you to replace Morris immediately.
So I'll start when? Wednesday?
They'll have a criminal court judge swear you in first thing Wednesday morning.
Are you serious? I don't think I'm ready. I wasn't ready. I'd never done anything remotely similar.
You don't have any choice. You wanted to be the district attorney general, and now you've gotten what you wanted. It's time to hit the ground running.
Chapter 31. The cops finally did show up around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There were two of them, both men, one younger and one older. I didn't recognize either of them as they flashed their badges at me, but there was a sleaze factor about them I noticed immediately. One introduced himself as Detective Henry Scott. He was a black man, about 45, with a pot belly and a closely trimmed goatee. He was wearing a brown leather jacket and tinted wire-framed glasses. He also smelled like a teenager on his way to the prom, the result of entirely too much repugnant cologne. The guy reminded me of someone straight out of the 70s. The other man was early 30s, an acne-scarred kid named Josh Pence, with long, scraggly, sandy blonde hair, a beard, and a screw-you attitude. I'd cross-examined guys like them dozens of times in court, and had learned that to them, lying was a second language. I knew before they put their badges away they were vice, most likely narcotics. I invited them in, which seemed to surprise them, and offered them bottles of water. We sat down at my kitchen counter, and I said, What can I do for you, gentlemen? Looks like you might be the new district attorney, Henry Scott said. Wednesday morning, from what I'm told. Heard about the murders last night. Is that a rhetorical question? Of course I've heard. Does this place look like a cave to you? I hated to hear it, too. I didn't like Morris, but I didn't want him dead. I was looking forward to putting him in jail after I beat him. That's funny, the young detective said, and he let out a short chuckle. The thought of you putting people in jail? The smirk he wore on his face was something that definitely needed to go, and I was in just the right mood to remove it. Oh yeah, Pence? Was that your name, Pence? Why would you say that? I already knew the answer, but I just wanted to bait him. Because everybody and his brother knows you should be under the damned jail, if not on death row. That right, wise ass? You got proof of that? You got some stones, man, Pence said. Everybody's talking about it. I mean, running for district attorney after all the shit you've pulled and gotten away with. You're a legend in your own mind. And you're a punk with a smart mouth. I'd be careful about who I judge, especially when you're nothing but a phony who goes out on the street, does drugs with people, gets them to trust you, and then busts them for trusting you. You're worse than most of the criminals out there, as far as I'm concerned. You're a professional snitch, a rat with a badge. Fuck you, man, Pence said. Maybe me and you should step outside. You go outside if you want. If you talk me into coming with you, you'll just wind up in the hospital. You also might want to keep in mind that it won't be long before you're going to be bringing cases to my office for me to present to the grand jury. I'm sure you know the district attorney makes all the calls on all those cases, so before you open that pie hole of yours again, you might want to try thinking things through a little. Whoa now, whoa, Scott said. We're getting off on the wrong foot here. They were definitely getting off on the wrong foot. All I'd done, as far as I was concerned, was let them into my home. I was beginning to regret that decision, and they were extremely close to being rudely ejected. What do you want? I said. Mind if I ask you where you were last night? Scott said. Yeah, I mind. I don't talk to cops. I exercise my right to remain silent as a matter of principle. Why do you want to know? We're investigating the death of Leslie Sabin. I thought about it for a second. Morris and his wife were killed in the county, which made the case Sheriff Corker's jurisdiction. Harrison was killed in an abandoned warehouse in the county, also Corker's jurisdiction. But Sabin lived in an apartment in the city. You guys are vice, I said. I think we've already established that. You're not homicide, so why are you out investigating a murder? We do double duty when one of our informants gets popped, Scott said. Shit. The cops Claire had told me about were sitting in my kitchen. Two dirty cops, having taken advantage of both Leslie Sabin and Stephen Morris. I couldn't resist having a little fun at their expense. Leslie Sabin was an informant, so you know she was sleeping with Morris. Scott's eyebrows raised, and his mouth dropped open a little. He looked over at his partner, then back at me. What makes you think she was sleeping with Morris? My patience was running thinner by the second, but I really wanted to mess with their heads. Instead, Scott had apparently decided to play some mind games of his own. Doesn't matter, I said. She was sleeping with him. You know it, and I know it. We didn't know she was sleeping with him, Scott said. Man, you guys are in way over your heads, I said. Was everything Stephen Morris touched corrupt? The way I understand it, you two got lucky and popped Leslie Sabin on a possession with intent to resell, a felony, and she got her boyfriend, Stephen Morris, to ask you to back off. But you guys had no doubt heard that Morris is a corrupt prick, so you decided to shake him down a little. In exchange for agreeing to drop the charges, you got Morris to agree to get yet another member of the law enforcement community to provide Leslie with enough pills so that she could sell them and make a good profit. You two took a percentage of that profit. Ring a bell? I know what you're wondering right now. Where is this man getting his information? Especially because the information is accurate. Am I right? Do you feel like you've taken a hit of LSD right now? Are your minds absolutely blown? Both of them looked like they were about to vomit. You, Detective Scott, probably needed a new leather jacket or a nice car for your girlfriend, Detective Pence probably has a really serious Viagra addiction. So you set it up, and you probably let the other dealers around know that Leslie was protected so nobody robbed her or killed her. But somebody obviously didn't get the message. I swear this whole town is a cesspool. The county is bad, but I didn't know until recently that Morris had scams in the city, too. So why did you come by here, really? Why would you even think I killed Morris's girlfriend? Because it's what you do, man, Pence said. You wiped out your competition, his wife, his girl, and his best friend all in one night, and we intend to prove it. He was trying to act tough, but the bravado wasn't working. Yeah, well, good luck with that one, I said. You can go now. In the meantime, I suggest you both resign before I get settled into the office Wednesday and start looking around at corruption in the city's narcotics division. You might even want to leave the state. Chapter 32. I hit the ground running just a few days later. There were 35 lawyers in the office besides me, 36 until Jim Harrison was murdered. There was a support staff of 36 that included receptionists, victim witness coordinators, a legislative liaison, three investigators, grant writers, and several others who performed a variety of jobs. The first couple of days I was in office, courts were in session all over the county, so I couldn't just shut everything down and meet with everyone. I had a secretary call Morris's father and ask where his family wanted the things from his office moved. Then I asked her to hire a moving company to take Morris's things where his father directed. I know it must have appeared hard-hearted to those in the office, but the space was already tight, and there really wasn't anything else I could have done. Meanwhile, I watched the news reports very closely. Sheriff Tree Corker said they were all over this investigation, that they would find the killer or killers of Stephen Morris and his wife and Jim Harrison if they had to chase them to the gates of hell. All you have to do is chase yourself into the bathroom and look in the mirror, I thought. That Saturday morning, a week after the murders, at 7, I rented a banquet room at a hotel in Knoxville out of my own pocket and made sure everyone in the office knew that attendance was mandatory. Claire came with me. I'd asked her to stay on a couple of extra weeks to help me get things organized, and she'd agreed. She already had an organizational chart for the office prepared. All we had to do was fill in the boxes with real people. I also rented a suite in the motel where I could interview people privately while Claire talked to the group. She outlined the organizational chart and informed them how things would be run in the future. The dockets would be tightened up. Cases wouldn't be continued without a legitimate reason. If a police officer was subpoenaed to court and didn't show up for his or her case, it would be dismissed and his shift commander and the police chief would be notified immediately. It was the same with the sheriff's department. If officers were going to arrest people and bring cases, they had to show up for court. I started interviewing the lawyers who had been with the DA's office the longest, and I asked them four questions. What did they think about Morris? What did they think about Jim Harrison? What did they think about Ben Clancy when he was the district attorney? And what did they think about the job the investigators in the office were doing? I encouraged them to be open and honest, and promised their answers would remain confidential. They were leery of me, of course, but one of them, a salt-and-pepper-haired 15-year veteran named Tom Masoner, who prosecuted violent crime in criminal court and didn't seem to care much about what anybody thought of him, spoke right up. Morris was spineless, and I think he was a criminal, Masoner said. I hate to speak ill of the dead, but he had to be skimming money, and a lot of it, from somewhere. Go take a look at his house and how he lived. I knew him when he was an assistant DA, before he beat Clancy, and he lived very frugally. Maybe he inherited a ton, or maybe his wife hit the lottery, but he invited me to his house about 6 weeks ago, and I was stunned. Luxury everywhere. I know, I said. It's one of the things I became aware of during the campaign. What about Jim Harrison? What did you think of him? A secretive weasel whose only purpose seemed to be to follow Morris around with his nose up his ass. Clancy, don't get me started. What he did to you was terrifying. If my wife hadn't just given birth to our second child, I would have quit over that. What do you think happened to Clancy? Masoner smiled and winked at me. I think someone he railroaded, and you weren't the only one he railroaded, removed him from the gene pool. And if someone removed him from the gene pool, that someone did the rest of us a favor. Do you know the investigators who work in the office? Of course. Their real names are Colton, Pete, and Duffner. But I call them Winkin', Blinkin', and Nod. You know the poem? They're sleepy children in search of fantasy fish. They never catch a thing. They do nothing. Have you seen them? As a matter of fact, I haven't. They go about 900 pounds between the three of them. I guarantee you they're sleeping through the meeting downstairs right now, and they wiped out half the pastry table before the rest of us got near it. So they don't get out and investigate? They don't make cases? Didn't you hear me? They eat donuts. If you want to find them at nearly any time during the day, you can go to the break room. There'll be about a 90% shot they'll be stuffing their faces. I smiled at him, leaned toward him, and reached my hand out. You're my guy, I said. He shook the hand and said, What do you mean? You're going to be second in command in the office. I need someone I can trust, and although I've known you for only about 10 minutes, I think I can trust you. You're going to decide which lawyers get assigned to the criminal courts. I want aggressive litigators and trial lawyers, not pussies who plea bargain everything on the docket. If there's dead wood, figure out a way to get rid of it and recruit some real lawyers. I'll find a way to get you a raise. You up for that? Masoner nodded and smiled back at me. Finally, a man who recognizes true talent when he sees it. I thought Masoner might eventually come to the realization that I was a man who operated in the gray areas of the law, that things weren't always rigid. But I also thought he might be okay with it, as long as I was able to keep him from knowing too much. Besides, I wasn't planning on running a dirty office. It would be clean, and I was sincere about getting aggressive trial lawyers and litigators into the criminal courts. I just hoped he'd be able to deal with my affinity for the Tipton family, and maybe certain other things, if the need arose. I think we're going to get along well, I said, and I'm going to have some stuff coming down the pike I think you'll enjoy. What kind of stuff? Can't tell you yet. I think I trust you, but not enough. Sounds like fun. When do I start this house cleaning? Monday, but before you do, I need to ask you another question. How well do you know the TBI agents in the Knoxville office? I know all of them pretty well. I need an intro, and it needs to be a good one. Chapter 33. At Granny's request, that Saturday night, Claire and I made a trip up the mountain to visit the Tiptons. Granny hadn't told me she was planning a party, but that's exactly what it was. A victory party for the new district attorney of Knox County was being held on top of a mountain in Sevier County by a woman who had committed plenty of criminal acts during her lifetime and would no doubt commit more. It was cold on the mountain that night, so the extended Tipton family, several people I didn't know, Claire and I ate in Eugene's house, which was much larger than Granny's. It was one of those grand-scale log cabins, and it was beautiful. Once we'd eaten and the table was cleared, four guys started pulling musical instruments out of cases, and before I knew it, a full-blown, knee-slapping bluegrass concert was going on in Eugene's living room. People spilled out onto the wraparound deck, and Eugene and Ronnie built a huge fire about 100 feet from the cabin. I tried to stick with beer, but when the Tiptons were involved, moonshine inevitably became a part of the party. Even Claire gave in to Granny's persuasion, and it wasn't long before I saw her loosen up and look at me in a way that made me think I'd best keep my distance from her, or we'd wind up doing something we'd later regret. The people at the party were the Tiptons' friends and employees. A few of them looked vaguely familiar. I'd probably seen them at the last party I'd attended at Granny's, but for the most part, I didn't know a soul outside of the Tipton family and Claire. Granny had made an impromptu speech before we ate and announced to everyone that I was the new district attorney of Knox County and that some very lucrative new opportunities were going to be opening up for their family business. Everybody seemed to be in a fine mood, and I was definitely the guest of honor and the man of the hour. There was something I wanted to talk to Granny about, though, and I was worried about how she would react. The Tiptons had made a great deal of money selling prescription drugs over the years. The market was huge and growing by the day. I didn't know exactly how their operation worked, but Granny had obviously figured out a way to secure a reliable supplier, because I hadn't seen any signs that they were manufacturing the drugs. I figured the Tiptons then sold the pills to distributors, who sold to dealers, who sold to users. That was the way other operations I'd seen throughout my career worked, and they were probably the same. Granny had mentioned moving into Knox County when I was elected, but I didn't want her dealing drugs in the county where I was the DA. When I was doing the rubber chicken circuit, I'd heard of all the devastation prescription pills were causing. The suicides, the overdoses, the breaking up of marriages and alienation of extended families, the extremely ugly damage the drugs had inflicted on innocent children. I decided I couldn't condone it. I wanted to spend time and resources going after the people who brought drugs into the county and ruined people's lives. I wanted to shut down doctors who operated pill mills. District attorneys around the country were banding together and beginning to file lawsuits against the drug manufacturers who made billions and didn't give a damn about the carnage their products caused. I could handle the gambling, but I didn't want to stand idly by and look the other way while Granny and her family imported drugs into Knox County. I walked over to Granny, who was standing by the fire wrapped in a heavy coat and wearing a stocking cap on her head. "Can we talk for a little while?" I said.
"Sure. Let's take a walk."
There was no snow on the ground, but it was in the 30s, with a slight damp breeze blowing. The ground was firm beneath my feet, and the fire cast a warm glow and caused shadows to jump along the ridges and trees that looked like ancient spirits who had come out to dance at the edge of the forest.
"Have you gotten started at your new job?"
Granny said. "I have. Didn't have any choice, really, and I haven't gotten much done. But I went in Wednesday and have been pretty much nonstop ever since. We even met with a bunch of employees for most of the day today."
"Terrible what happened to Morris," she said. "I suppose I could understand if they thought Morris would turn rat on them, but his wife, that wasn't right."
"They didn't just kill his wife. They killed his girlfriend, too."
"That young girl that was in the news that got murdered the same night? That was Morris's girlfriend?"
"Yeah, Morris apparently gave her drugs to sell and to take. Talk about dating the wrong guy at the wrong time. And the lawyer who got shot in his car was Morris's bagman. They definitely wanted to shut everybody up."
"You got any ideas on who might have done it?"
Granny said. "I have suspicions. I was hoping you might help me out."
"It was probably Roby Pan," Granny said.
"Could have been," I said. "I've been hearing about him for months, and none of it has been good." I didn't know why, but I was uncomfortable sharing what I'd seen when I was sitting on the water the night Morris was killed. I didn't want to tell her about the pearl-handled pistols. Besides, I couldn't positively identify anyone. I hadn't gotten a look at a single face.
"From everything I know about Roby Pan," Granny said, "he's a bad hombre, and getting worse by the minute. He has to go, and soon."
"How?" I said.
"We're counting on you, Darren. You'll figure something out."
I was beginning to wonder whether I really could do anything about Roby Penn. He seemed so deeply ingrained in what was going on in the county, and he was so violent, that I didn't know whether I could take him on. I decided I'd worry about it later. "Do you by any chance have any idea what happened to that Marine? You've heard about him, right?"
"Yeah, I've heard, and I think I know what happened. There's a big network of men who attend those bare-knuckle fights in counties all over the Appalachians. They send out mass text messages when the fights are going to happen. Eugene and Ronnie know more about it than I do, but they've told me some things. The mass text seems like a stupid way to operate because it seems to me the cops could come in, grab up one phone, and they'd have everybody on the list. But the police just aren't interested in what they're doing, because they do it in counties where they know they can pay people off."
"Right. But back to the question, do you know who killed Gary Brewer?"
"The word I got is that when the fight started, the Marine knocked the boy he was fighting, name's Harley Shaker out of Cock County, knocked him down and spat on him. Now, I don't know Harley Shaker personally, but I know some of the Shaker family, and I would think that if you spit on one of them, even during a fight, you would do so at your peril. It'd be looked at the same as pissing on him."
"So Brewer spit on this Harley Shaker, and Shaker beat him to death?"
"That's what people who ain't supposed to be saying anything are saying."
"Heard anything about what happened to his body?" Granny shook her head.
When something like that happens, everybody runs. So I haven't heard anybody say what happened to the body. My guess, though, is that Roby Penn would have had to take care of it. It happened at his place, from what I hear. He would have cleaned up the mess.
I was wearing gloves, but my fingers were beginning to tingle, so I shoved my hands in my jacket pocket. "What else do you know about Roby Penn?" I said.
"Quite a bit, but probably not as much as I should. They say you should keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Roby's an enemy, and he doesn't even know it."
"I should know more about him.
I know his family is from around here, that he had kinfolk who served in World War II, and that he enlisted and went to Vietnam, wound up getting wounded. I know that a couple of years after he got out, the state government came in and wanted a piece of his property to build a highway. He told them to go to hell, so they took it under eminent domain. When they came out with the bulldozers to start the work, Roby started firing at them with a deer rifle. He could have killed several of them, but he didn't. Still, they gave him 6 years in prison for it. Then his son got killed in Iraq by his own guys. What do they call that? Friendly fire?
Yeah, that's it. Friendly fire.
The army tried to cover it up. Roby stayed on them, though, and the truth finally came out. Several years ago, after he'd done the 6 years in prison, he quit filing income tax returns and quit paying taxes. That cost him another year, but he had to go to a federal pen. So he's had run-ins with local, state, and federal governments, and he hates them all. He's in his mid-60s now, and these murders tell me he might be going off the deep end.
So you want me to go at Roby the old-fashioned way or the newfangled way? Old-fashioned is figure out a way to get him into a confrontation and kill him. Newfangled is the cop way. Get informants in, do surveillance, and get him on tape. Find out who was with him when he killed Morris and his wife and jumped in the boat. Put all of them on trial and in prison. Granny stopped and looked up at me.
Jumped in the boat? What are you talking about?
Nothing, just a theory. I've already heard around the office that they escaped from Morris's house on the water. She gave me a look that told me she didn't necessarily believe me, but she turned and started walking again.
Now, I don't think you're going to get him the cop way. Do you know the tie between Roby Penn and the sheriff?
I think I've heard they're related, but I don't know how exactly.
Roby is Tree Corker's mother's oldest brother, which makes him Tree's uncle.
Nepotism at its finest, I said.
That's how it's usually done. Now, what was it you want to talk to me about?
I took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
Must be bad, she said.
Granny, you've been so good to me, and I know when I agreed to do this district attorney thing, I said you could do whatever you want. But I've changed my mind about part of it. I'd like to ask you to please not sell any drugs in Knox County. When I was out campaigning, I talked to so many people whose families had been devastated by drugs, people whose lives had been ruined. You can take on as many gambling rackets as you want, and if you insist on doing the drug trade, I won't go back on what I said. But would you please consider not selling the drugs in Knox County? It would be a huge favor to me.
We could build that county into a $1 million-a-year enterprise just with the pills, she said. Probably more.
You'll make twice that off the gambling.
You know the old saying, you must be talking out of your butt because your mouth has to know better.
But the gambling is still good, right? With the other money you're already pulling in from other counties, how much do you need?
I hate the drugs, Darren. Always have. Eugene and Ronnie handle most of that side of the business because it turns my stomach. The kind of people you have to deal with, the class of people, it's just disgusting. That's why we got out of it for a while. But it's just so lucrative, it's hard to walk away. Especially when you've been as poor as we were back in the days when my husband was alive and we went to church and followed the laws and acted like sheep in a herd. He had his little side hustles like the bar and a couple of trailers out back. But when he died, we barely had a pot to piss in and I had to scratch and claw just to keep this place going and keep food in our bellies and clothes on our backs. That's when I made up my mind I was going to get rich and wasn't going to be poor ever again. There just can't ever be too much money.
So I can't talk you out of it, I said. She breathed deeply, stopped again, and looked me square in the eye.
"We can make a deal," she said. "You becoming the district attorney has been good, Darren. Good for you, good for us. But Roby's gone off the deep end if he killed Morris and the others. I can't say it for sure, but I'm usually right about these things. With Morris gone, Roby will dig in deeper than a tick in a dog's neck and dare you or anybody else to try and stop him. You can try using your informants. You can try making arrests, putting pressure on people. Maybe eventually you'll get enough to arrest and convict him, but it's going to take a long time. And if you take your shot and you miss, he'll come after you."
"So what are you saying, Granny?"
"Kill him, Darren," she said. "It'll be just like Clancy. We'll help you if you need us, and once it's over, we'll all be better off. And if you kill him, I promise we won't sell a single pill in your county."
Part 3. Chapter 34. The summons from the governor of the state of Tennessee came early Sunday morning in the form of a telephone call from Senator Roger Tate, negating the need for Tom Masoner, my new best buddy at the DA's office, to get me some intros at the TBI. Senator Tate said I was to meet the governor, along with several other heavy hitters, at the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation's headquarters in Strawberry Plains, Monday at 8 a.m. sharp. The senator said neither he nor Claire would be attending. I walked in the next morning wearing my best suit, the charcoal one Claire had purchased for me before the political rally. When I walked through the door, the governor looked at me in a way that made me feel small and insignificant, and I suppose I was, compared with a couple of the others in the room. The governor, a Republican, Theo Bradbury, sat at the head of the table. He was flanked by the director of the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, the commissioner of the Tennessee Department of Safety and Homeland Security, the chief of police of Knoxville, and high sheriff of Knox County, Tree Corker. Noticeably absent were representatives from the federal government. There wasn't a U.S. attorney or an FBI agent in sight. "Gentlemen," the governor said after everyone was seated, "I'm here to impress upon you the importance of solving these hideous murders that took place last Saturday. I mean, can you imagine the way the people of this district and people all over Tennessee are feeling at this minute? They're feeling unsafe and wondering whether the people they've elected to represent them can protect them. The fact that a person or persons would walk into the home of an elected district attorney general and kill both him and his wife is simply unfathomable to me. The fact that an assistant district attorney general was murdered on the same night, in his car at an abandoned warehouse, is also extremely disturbing. I've heard rumors, though no one has been able to confirm them, that the young Sabin woman who was killed that night was also involved with General Morris. This case has to be tied off with no loose ends. It has to have palatable explanations for the public, and it has to be done right away. Sheriff Corker, your department has immediate jurisdiction over the case. What can you share with us?" Corker looked uncomfortable. Beads of sweat were visible on his forehead, and his face was pinker than usual.
"I agree. It's horrible, and it's important," Corker said. "We've put every resource we have into the case."
"What do you have? Are there any leads? Anything promising?"
Corker shook his head.
"I'm sorry, Governor, but we have very little right now."
"Have you interviewed any suspects?" The question came from Haynes Howell III, the director of the TBI, who was sitting to my left. He was in his mid-50s, a balding, light-skinned black man who looked more like a super-bureaucrat than a super-agent. He'd been head of the agency for 12 years and had just been appointed by the governor to another 6-year term. I'd heard early in my law career that the director of the TBI answered to no one and had done some research. It was true. He was appointed by the governor, but he had free rein. Nobody looked over his shoulder, which, I believed, was deemed necessary to make him an effective leader.
"Unfortunately, we don't have any suspects," Corker said.
"No suspects," Howell said. "You have a man who is about to go up for re-election and get badly beaten, from what I understand, who is murdered in his home along with his wife. This man is the district attorney and makes roughly $150,000 a year, yet he lives on 20 acres on the lake in a 6,000-square-foot home and has a garage full of luxury cars. Have you checked bank accounts, credit card receipts, safe deposit boxes? Is his family wealthy?
We're checking into all of those things, Tree said.
You're checking? It's been more than a week. What have you found?
I don't appreciate you talking to me in that tone of voice, Corker said. You have no jurisdiction here.
Unless the new district attorney general asks me for help, Howell said. Tennessee law allowed local district attorney generals to ask the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation for help on matters or investigations in which the local resources may not have been adequate.
We don't need your help, Corker barked. We're on it, I'm telling you. All of my investigators are on it, all of my people. We're checking every lead, every angle.
What about the girlfriend? Howell said.
What about her? You've interviewed friends and family, gone through her financials, correct? Anything significant? The girlfriend isn't my case. You'll have to talk to the chief about her.
Howell turned his attention to the Knoxville police chief, a man named Jim Boswell. Boswell was nearing retirement. He looked tired and didn't seem to want to be involved.
What has your investigation revealed, Chief? Howell said.
Not much, other than she was having an affair with Morris. No forensics to speak of. We found a couple of small things and sent them off to the lab, but I'm not too hopeful.
I thought briefly about informing Boswell that two of his vice cops knew Leslie Sabin well, but I decided to keep it to myself. I'd no doubt have to work with him in the future, and I didn't think a couple of small-timers like Scott and Pence were worth burning the bridge.
What about Jim Harrison? Howell said, turning his attention back to the sheriff. Any theory as to why he was murdered?
We're looking into it, Corker said.
I wanted to reach across the table and slap Corker. He'd calmed down some, his complexion had lightened a bit, and he was becoming smug.
This absolutely will not stand, Governor Bradbury said. What about you, Mr. Street? Or I suppose I should call you General Street now, correct? Do you have any theories on just what is going on in this mess of a district you've inherited?
Not only did I have theories, I'd seen two of the murders that had been committed. However, that didn't mean I had cases I could take to court and prove to a jury. But Roby Penn and Tree Corker had ramped things up significantly when they decided to silence their victims in the election massacre, as the papers had begun to call the murders.
I have some theories, I said, but I have to rely on the sheriff here to bring me proof, and so far I haven't seen anything. He hasn't asked us to help with subpoenas or warrants. He hasn't asked for a thing. So the only thing I can assume is that the sheriff isn't at a point where he needs those things.
I'm not. Corker said, don't need subpoenas or warrants, at least not yet. When we get to that point, we'll come knocking.
And when might that be? The governor said.
I just don't know, Corker said. Cases go unsolved sometimes. Criminals are clever. There wasn't a single piece of forensic evidence at Morris's home outside of the bullets that got taken out of the victims' heads, Corker said. The killer or killers even picked up the shell casings. Unless they were using revolvers. Ballistics hasn't told us yet exactly what kind of gun the bullets came from. My forensics team didn't find a hair, a fiber, a footprint, or a fingerprint. Not even a partial. It was like a ghost committed those crimes. As for Harrison, same thing.
What about phones? Howell said.
What about them?
I assume you've gone through the call logs and contacts and all the other data on the victims' phones?
We have. We haven't found a thing.
Corker was lying through his teeth, which was exactly what I'd expected him to do, but there was nothing I could do about it, at least not at the moment.
And I don't suppose you ever made any progress on the Marine you were looking for, Gary Brewer? Howell said.
The new investigation has taken priority over Mr. Brewer, the sheriff said.
The governor looked around the room.
Does anyone have anything else to say?
There was so much I wanted to say, I was practically bursting. My heart rate was up and my hands were trembling.
Then I guess I've wasted my time, Governor Bradbury said.
He got up and stormed out the door, followed quickly by everyone else. As soon as I got to my car, I dug my throwaway cell phone out of my briefcase and called Claire. "Can you get a hold of your grandfather on short notice?" I said.
"Usually."
"Good, because I need to talk to the director of the TBI. Have him call me at this number on a secure phone before he leaves to go back to Nashville." I thanked Claire, hung up the phone, and drove toward my new office, hoping he would call. Chapter 35.
"What can I do for you, sir?" Haynes Howell's voice was cold and demanding over the phone. I was back in my office going through a pile of reassignments Tom Masoner had recommended. He was apparently already spreading the word, too, because my email folder was full of messages from people who weren't happy. I got up, walked around the desk, and closed the door.
"Actually, there are some things I can do for you," I said. "I certainly didn't hear anything useful in the meeting we had a little while ago."
"I know, and I'm sorry. I couldn't say much, but I need to talk to you. Alone. Someplace where nobody will see us together. And I mean nobody, including people from the TBI.
"Why would I want to talk to you, Mr. Street? Unless you want to make a confession or two?"
"Because I can help you blow this whole thing out of the water?"
Howell paused for a bit.
"I don't believe you," he said. "If you have information pertinent to Mr. Morris's murder or any other murders, why don't you just call in my agents in Knoxville and get to work?"
"Because I have reason to believe your agents, or at least one of them, may have been compromised."
"Compromised how? Do you know what? You're really something. Your name has run across my desk more than once in the past as being a suspect in multiple murders. Now you have somehow managed to gain the ear of one of the most powerful men in the country and have gotten yourself elected to the district attorney's office in Knoxville, which means there will no longer be any investigation of you in that city for any crime you may have committed. And now you get me on the phone, tell me you can blow this whole thing out of the water, yet you insult the integrity of my agents and my organization in the process? Do you really believe I want to have anything at all to do with you, despite what some washed-up old fool like Roger Tate says?"
"First off, I'd be careful about who I call a washed-up old fool if I want to keep my J. Edgar Hoover clone job. And secondly, if you could manage to put that tremendous ego of yours in your pocket for just 10 minutes and give me a little time, I guarantee you won't regret it. Your agency will take down one of the most corrupt organizations in Tennessee since Ray Blanton was selling pardons out of the state capitol, and you'll come out smelling like the proverbial rose. And you, Mr. Street, what will you get? Some peace of mind, maybe some redemption, a little more sleep?" He paused again for several seconds.
"All right, I'll talk to you at a safe house. You can't know where it is, though. I'm going to send one of my personal security agents, the agent I trust the most, to pick you up. He'll be in a black SUV with tinted windows. You get in the van, he'll hand you a bag, you put it over your head until he takes it off."
"No cuffs," I said, "no shackles."
"You won't be a prisoner, Mr. Street, but if you want to do this in a secure fashion, then this is the best way. He can be at your apartment in 20 minutes.
"You know where my apartment is?"
"I know a lot about you, Mr. Street. Dress warmly. We'll be outside and it'll be cold."
I left the office and drove straight to my apartment. I went inside, grabbed an overcoat, some gloves, and a stocking cap, and went back outside. The SUV pulled in just a couple of minutes later. The back passenger door opened, and I climbed in.
"Put this on," a gruff voice said as a lightweight black hood landed in my lap. "Don't even look at me."
I did as the agent said, and we rolled out of the parking lot. 45 minutes later, the SUV stopped. From the sounds and the way the vehicle felt while I was riding, I was sure we had driven to Pigeon Forge or Sevierville, or maybe even Gatlinburg. The mountains were full of chalets that people rented, and I was betting we were heading for one of them.
"Stay put," the agent said. "I'll come around and lead you in."
The door beside me opened a few seconds later, and the agent took me by the elbow. He guided me up 3 steps onto a porch, through a door, and we stepped into a house that had a neutral, unused smell to it. It smelled clean, like they had someone come in and dust and vacuum on a regular basis, but there weren't really any human smells outside of the agent's aftershave.
"We're going to step through some French doors, and you can take the hood off," the agent said.
I did so, the agent closed the door behind me and disappeared, and there sat Haynes Howell III, wearing an overcoat, gloves, and a wide-brimmed hat. He was smoking a pipe and drinking a cup of coffee. He didn't bother to offer me one. I was on the outdoor deck overlooking the mountains. They were beautiful, even without the colorful canopy of leaves on the trees. We were high up. I could see for miles, but I didn't recognize a single landmark. I had no idea where I was. "Nice place," I said. "We use it for our special snitches," Howell said. "I think you live to annoy me. I hate the term snitch. Don't use it when you're referring to me." "Because of the time you spent in prison?" "Exactly, and I'm serious. If you call me a snitch again, I'll punch you in the mouth." For the first time since we'd met, a smile crossed Howell's face. "You're a pugnacious little bastard, aren't you?" "I suppose I am. I was always a little on the small side, and I've always had to fight to keep people from taking advantage of me." "That's called a small man complex," Howell said. "Maybe so, but call me a snitch again, and you're going to get a dose of it." "How about we stop flexing our muscles at each other and get down to business?" Howell said. "Fine. Where do you want to start?" "I don't know. How about at the beginning?" "I can't, because there are some things I can't tell you about." "Okay, I'm wasting my time again." Howell started to get up. "Wait," I said. "I might be pugnacious, but you're impatient and melodramatic. I have informants. I can't tell you who they are, but I'd trust some of them with my life. What my informants began telling me is that the district attorney of Knox County and the sheriff were allowing certain criminals to run their operations without fear of arrest or prosecution, in return for a cut of the illegal proceeds. The operation began back when Ben Clancy was the district attorney general, and Joe DeBose was the sheriff, and has continued until this day." "So we're talking 10 years or more," Howell said. "More. And what kind of criminals are being allowed to run their operations? Cockfighters, dogfighters, bare-knuckle boxers, pimps, human traffickers, drug dealers, gamblers. Same old story. Where there's cash, there's corruption. In this case, they allow select people to run their operations without fear of arrest or prosecution or competition, in exchange for a price. If a competitor comes in, the original criminal suddenly becomes an informant. It's basically an extortion scheme. The difference is that the extortion scheme isn't being run by gangsters, it's being run by the sheriff and the district attorney." "How much money are we talking about here?" "Millions. Check into the amount of money Stephen Morris made and compare it with the value of the assets he held at his death. If you dig deeply enough, you'll probably find some money stashed offshore, too." "And the sheriff?" "He's larger than life, and he's dumber than a bag of hammers, but he knows better than to flaunt the money. From everything I know, he lives under the radar. God knows where his money is stashed." "And what precipitated these murders, do you think?" "I did, by coming in and beating Morris," I said. "I think once Morris realized he was going to lose his candy store, he threatened to go to law enforcement, and they killed him before he got the chance." "Do you think the sheriff was involved in the murders?" "I think he drove the boat that carried the murderers away from Morris's house." "And why do you think that?" "Because I saw it, but there's no way I could ever testify to it." Howell pulled his pipe out of his mouth and set it on the table. "Start talking before you get yourself arrested." I told him as much as I could, about how it started with Grace dying, about going to Morris, about how I made up my mind that I was going to run against Morris and told the TBI agents about it when they came to my door asking about Dr. Futura. I told him an old friend, but I wouldn't mention any names, knew Senator Tate from way back, and that he agreed to give me support and bring his granddaughter in to help me. I told him about how Senator Tate had pleaded with me to find out what had happened to the Marine, Captain Gary Brewer, and I told him what I suspected had happened. I told him about the rally and how great things were going, but that Morris just wouldn't shut up about the old, unproven allegations against me. "I made a bad decision," I said. "I got it in my mind that if I could get him alone and talk to him, maybe even threaten him, that he'd shut up about all that old stuff." I failed to tell him that I might very well have killed Morris myself had Roby Penn not beaten me to it. I did tell him about the surveillance I'd done and how I was sitting on the water the night two masked men murdered Morris and his wife. I told him about the boat that rolled in to pick up the men from Morris's dock and how the driver, while he was wearing a mask, was also massive and had what appeared to be two pearl-handled pistols and holsters tied to his thighs. I couldn't identify him positively, I said. I couldn't identify any of them positively, but I've never seen anyone else carry pistols like those. So you think the sheriff was definitely one of them? One of them was the sheriff. He didn't pull any triggers, but he's guilty of conspiracy to commit murder and felony murder because he drove the boat. One of the others was more than likely a man named Roby Penn. He's Sheriff Corker's uncle, a fringe guy who hates the government and lives off the gambling rackets. Does really well with it, from what I've heard. Fixes a lot of bare-knuckle fights and cleans up. Bets on the roosters and the dogs and collects a gate and the juice. Operates some gambling machines, some card games, a small casino. It isn't a racket he'd want to lose. Roby is one of the sheriff's biggest producers. Plus, he's kin. The only other racket that would come close to the gambling they have set up is drugs, and I'm sure you know better than I do what kind of money drugs generate. The other rackets are smaller, but they all add up. Roby and the drugs are the big ones. They're the ones the sheriff would not want to lose. And how does the money get from all these people to Corker? My informant tells me he just goes out and collects it. He isn't shy about it either. He's like one of those small-time insurance salesmen who shows up at your house every month to collect the premium. Hell, he drives his cruiser, from what I understand. And what about Morris? How did he get his cut? Jim Harrison was his bag man. Morris apparently had enough brains not to do business with the sheriff directly. He had Harrison collect the money. Harrison was just another loose end they tied up. And the girl, the Sabin girl? Morris was supplying her with drugs, but that isn't why they killed her. I think they killed her because they were afraid of what Morris may have told her. Yeah, pillow talk has gotten more than one person killed, Howell said. And you didn't want to go to the Knoxville TBI because you figured since it's been going on for so long, somebody there must be involved? I know the TBI has good informants. Hard for me to believe your guys didn't know anything about any of this, especially with all the time that has gone by. It's funny, you know, Howell said, suddenly taking on a semi-philosophical air. These criminals have it made. I mean, you take these guys, for example, probably doing a couple of million a year, maybe more, just off the gambling. Then you add the drugs and sex, and the numbers just go out the roof. But it's never enough for them, is it? They always need more. Always have to get greedy. And when they get greedy, somebody inevitably gets killed. And when somebody gets killed, they bring attention to themselves, and eventually their machine breaks down, and everybody winds up either dead or in jail. So what do we do about it? I said. I've told you pretty much everything I know. I guess we'll have to bring folks in from all over the state and start from the beginning. We'll have to infiltrate the groups, identify the major players, start getting things on tape and on video. It's going to be a big case. And it's going to take a long time. No way around it, Howell said. That's what I figured. Is that a problem? No, not a problem. I was just hoping to get some relief or some closure or whatever you want to call it for the Brewer family. I'd like to know what became of him. We'll find out eventually. Yeah, I suppose we will. So what do you want me to do? Do I just go about my business and leave them alone? That would look too suspicious. Talk to the sheriff. Tell him as long as there isn't any more violence, you'll call a truce and let things stay as they are. But you don't take a dime. We're clear on that, right? I don't want any of their money. And you might tell the sheriff he could throw you a bone by producing Gary Brewer's body, if there's a body left to produce. At least that'll look like some progress is being made. In the meantime, I'll mobilize my agents. We'll bring people in from Memphis, Nashville, Chattanooga, all over the state. You won't even know they're here, and neither will the agents in the Knoxville office. And rest assured, Mr. Street, I'll get to the bottom of what's going on in the Knoxville TBI office. I won't stand for corruption of any kind, even if it's just turning a blind eye.
So you'll coordinate this entire thing from Nashville?
I will.
It'll be top secret. Very, very few people will know about it, and those will only be people I can trust.
Good, I said, and I stood up. Now, if you don't mind, I think I'll ask your man to take me back down the mountain. I'm freezing.
Howell stepped toward me and reached out his hand.
You've done the right thing here today. Thank you for trusting me.
Any chance I can ride back without the hood? I said.
He shook his head.
Sorry. We have to keep you in the dark about some things.
Chapter 36. Claire called me at work around 6 to see whether I'd be home at 7. I told her I should be there by then, and an hour later she showed up at my place holding 2 bottles of wine and a bag of takeout from the best Chinese place in Knoxville.
This is a pleasant surprise, I said, reaching out to help her. She was dressed casually, but she looked as beautiful as ever.
I'm afraid it's going to be bittersweet, she said. I'm here to say goodbye.
I invited her in and we opened the wine. The food didn't seem appealing at the time. We sat down on the couch as I filled a couple of glasses.
I'm surprised, I said. I knew you'd head back eventually, but now that the time has come, I don't quite know how to feel. Do you really need to go back to the swamp? The job offer still stands.
I appreciate it, she said. But I'm not even licensed to practice law in the state of Tennessee. I haven't taken the bar.
That's an easy enough fix.
I will admit to you that I've looked through some materials, she said. I don't think I'd have any problem passing.
I looked at her and winked. I knew you wanted to stay, I said. I knew you couldn't resist me.
How did your meeting go? She said.
I don't know how much I should tell you, so I guess I'll just tell you everything. I recounted the day for her, including the clandestine meeting with Haynes Howell III.
Will they arrest anybody for murder? She said when I was finished.
I think that depends on how strong the bond is between Sheriff Corker and his uncle, Roby Penn. If they turn them against each other, they'll have a shot.
And what will you be doing?
Working my butt off. You've seen the mess at the office. It's going to take me a while just to get things running smoothly.
I have no doubt you'll get it done, she said.
She surprised me like that sometimes. She would be difficult and stubborn, and then she would turn right around and say something kind that genuinely boosted my confidence, because I knew she wouldn't say it if she didn't think it was true. I couldn't have done any of this without you, Claire, I said. Thank you. Before you came into my life, I was lost again, terribly angry, and had no real focus. I feel like I'm back on the right track now, and a lot of it is because of you. If you hadn't come along, I may very well have... Well, let's just leave it at I'm grateful for you.
Claire slid across the couch until her thigh was touching mine. She looked into my eyes and said,
I think we'll see each other again. I've never met anyone quite like you. You have this strength and resilience in you that anyone who gets to know you can see and comes to admire. You're like a strong tree in a hurricane, Darren, a tree that will bend and bend and bend, and maybe lose some branches, but it refuses to break. I'm happy for you, and I'm glad I was able to help you achieve what you wanted to achieve here.
She kissed me gently on the cheek and lingered. I felt her warm breath on my face, smelled the faint odor of the wine mixed with her perfume. Just as I was about to reach for her, she stood.
I'd better go, she said.
Go? You just got here.
I'm afraid this might get out of hand.
I stood in front of her and held her hands.
You're right. Thank you again, Claire. Anytime you need a break from the swamp, you know where to find me.
I hope you get what you want, Darren, she said. I hope you find some peace.
She picked up her purse, and I watched her walk out the door. I felt the urge to run after her into the parking lot, to beg her to stay, but I resisted. Instead, I picked up the half-empty bottle of wine off the table and drained it.
Chapter 37. Sheriff Corker pulled his Dodge pickup into the corner of the parking lot complex and parked next to the white Lexus. He got out and squeezed himself into the front seat of the Lexus next to the lawyer, who was beefy and wearing a tan suit and too much cologne. The lawyer pulled the shiny, expensive vehicle onto the highway and began to cruise north. Today, the sheriff wasn't wearing his cowboy hat or his uniform or his pythons. He wore bib overalls and a simple cap on his head. He could have been any farmer or auto parts store worker from any area of Tennessee. The lawyer called him sheriff. They'd met